The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Two independent inquiries, a slew of rumours and innuendo, and then what? As the government widens its investigation into historic child abuse cases, will it turn up anything new at all? Also this week, as public sector workers down tools and head for the picket lines, will they carry wider support? And wither liberalism? Is this once ubiquitous political creed in need of a comeback? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian's Michael White, our political columnist Polly Toynbee, and the author of a new book on liberalism, The Economist magazine's one-time journalist Edmund Fawcett. Welcome to you all. Now, the series of high-profile child abuse scandals at British institutions continues this week with the launch of two inquiries into the way that public bodies handled the allegations of abuse. Theresa May appointed former judge Elizabeth Butler-Sloss to head the main investigation, which is not expected to report until after the election next year. And then there's a second quickfire probe, more concerned with what the Home Office does with its files. Polly, if you were someone who remembered abuse in a care home or in an institution 20 or 30 years ago and had always been outraged by the idea that this had been known about and covered up, would the fact these investigations are now taking place cheer you up, do you think? Would it offer you some solace?
I think all investigations will offer them some solace. And Elizabeth Butler-Sloss is certainly highly reputable, highly experienced. But she was the wrong person. I think they'd forgotten who her brother was. And
her brother had been Attorney General in the Thatcher government.
Attorney General at the time when these reports were handed over. And I think it would be quite difficult for her if she uncovered something untoward that her brother had done or not done. And I think there will always be that suspicion, if anybody has any suspicion that Havers hid anything or covered up for a colleague or anything, people will go on having that suspicion. So I think, you know, it's a Caesar's wife, has to be above any suspicion. And I think it was a blunder. If I were her now, I would stand down. Quickly, because it'll rumble on. Unfair, so, but true.
Edmund, liberalism often struggles, doesn't it, with this idea of bringing in a disinterested perspective to arbitrate. You're not going to find a judge, though, who doesn't have establishment connections, are you?
Absolutely not. I mean, you hope for somebody who's going to be objective. It's never possible to find anybody who's neutral. A couple of things strike me. One is that, clearly, sexual abuse is, you know, wicked, repellent, and criminal. The other thing is that the attention given to it in Britain is striking and correct, but there are many, many other forms of child neglect that have wicked and damaging consequences: bad education, bad health, bad schools, low pay, poverty. So that always strikes me, the somewhat imbalance of attention. And the other thing is that it's one thing to keep government up to the mark when trust in government is generally high. It's another thing to keep the government up to the mark when the dangerous and absurd belief is spreading that government does anything, the government does nothing well.
Yeah.
And it's anyway.
And what do you think, Mike? I mean, is the government just in a no-win situation from here, from the point of view of trying to win back trust? Just.
Well, Edmund Fawcett is quite right to point out that this feeds the populist anti-politics agenda where they're all in it together. It's all a big conspiracy. Life is usually much more of a cock-up than a conspiracy, as everybody listening knows. Four or five successive Home Secretaries couldn't have covered up paedophile scandals. Why on earth should they? People were done. People in public life, a steady trickle have been done throughout my adult life. We forget so many of them, but in the last few days they've started coming out. Why are we obsessed with child sexual molestation? Because you know, society and certainly the tabloid press are obsessed with sex, although their failure to tackle these cases from Saville to Harris to Cyril Smith absolutely fascinates me. They keep telling us they're the protectors of the public good, the defenders of their readers, and they let themselves be cowed by Jimmy Savile. I know they tell us now they tried. Well, I wish they'd spent more time on Jimmy Savile and not on the tedious sex lives of footballers. Where were we? Hang on a minute. I think Polly's wrong, just to get back to the subject, to pick on Butler's loss. What worries me about her is that she's terribly old. She's 80. I don't know her. I know she's distinguished. I did know Michael Havers, the Attorney General of the time, a bit. He's a cheerful old criminal lawyer, a good old boy to have a drink with in the stranger's bar. Not a great intellectual, but not a bad man. His sister is clearly the more distinguished lawyer in the family. And, I don't think Paul's been quite fair in saying she doesn't have the intellectual nous and probity to bring the bad news home if she has to. In fact, you might say she'll be harder on her late brother than if he was somebody else's late brother.
I didn't want to suggest she wouldn't be in any way, but it's only about perception, and I do think that matters. You know, this is her brother she's going to be investigating. And although I'm absolutely sure, and I think she's totally got all her marbles from what I hear, sharp as anything, I think it is a question of how things look. When we've had this week a former Tory whip saying, well, of course, yes, if somebody had gotten into some trouble.
Tim Fortescue in an interview 30 years ago.
Yes, but if...
I mean, the world changes. You
indeed,
know, people felt differently 30 years
Hang
ago.
On.
We're
yes.
judging this with different standards.
I agree, and that's very difficult. And we need to remember the usefulness of that interview was that it was an interview done long ago, and it reminds us. And I can remember very well people making casual jokes about trouble with little boys, and there was an establishment attitude often that came out of people with public school experience and saying, well, you know, sex with your fag or whatever, that was all part of ordinary
life. They covered it up too. It's not just Westminster and Whitehall, and let's not leave the Catholic Church out of it either, since we're on the subject.
All true, but as you say, the attitudes were different, and I think you do sometimes have to look back and say, all right, the attitudes were different then, but there are still people who were damaged by it and who deserve to have an investigation.
Do you think, Edmund, that there's something, because we look back at that time, you know, the 1970s into maybe the early 80s, there's a time of liberalising of social mores around, I don't know, sex before marriage, around homosexuality and so on, and almost this stuff just got caught up with it and people thought, oh, well, you can't be too judgmental about these things. Do you think there was a problem of over-liberalisation in that sense?
No, I don't. I think you ought to be very clear. There are some things that are offline that are completely wrong and criminal. Sexual abuse of children is clearly one of them. A much more permissive attitude towards sex before marriage and so on. That's a completely different thing, and I don't see a tight connection between them.
But of course,
there's always been sexual abuse. There have always been elites that don't like embarrassment. It seems to me that to blame a cultural climate for episodes of sexual abuse, and the prevalence of it is not at all clear.
But the boundaries were very fluid, Edmund, at that time, were they not? And predators took opportunity of the confused and moving boundaries of the period, 60s, 70s, we all remember them, to try and get a hook in there. There was a fuss a few months ago about the paedophile information exchange. I remember being horrified by it at the time, but a lot of people said, oh, well, you know, we've got to review these things. We're not repressive Victorians anymore. That was part of the zeitgeist.
I certainly didn't, because I've looked back at a piece I wrote about the paedophile information exchange with some trepidation in the 70s at the time when they were affiliated to Liberty, and thought, oh, God, what did I say? Did I take some sort of absurd liberal view? Thank God I didn't.
Well done.
I was absolutely horrified by them.
But there was a thing this week about, you know, the Home Office had been reviewing the age of consent and... This came out, you know, we need to modernise some of these things. And not everything that they were saying was ridiculous. They were saying, you know, maybe the age of consent is an arbitrary line. It needs to be somewhere else.
Well, it has to be an arbitrary line.
It has to be an arbitrary line. And maybe we should look at where it is and all that kind of... You know, these were not silly things to say, but they didn't have the same awareness, maybe, of the lack of agency of children to make decisions, I think.
No, I agree, but I think I do think it's important to keep a line about what's criminal and has always been criminal, always been wrong, and shifting social attitudes towards sexual permissiveness.
But what's always criminal isn't always the same as what's always wrong. After all, homosexuality was criminal,
yes,
but not wrong.
But I don't think anybody's ever suggested that we decriminalise sexual abuse of children.
Well, apart from the paedophile.
Well, that's exactly what we are suggesting. They did suggest it.
Mike, do you think finally that is there some big scandal? Is your money on the fact that there'll be a big scandal that will emerge out of this and people will be horrified? Or do you think it will be something that will take so long to report, by the time it's reported, the world will have moved on, apart from the people who were directly affected by it, of course?
Well, conspiracy, the people affected by it in a different category, and some of them managed to shake these things off. We all know people have suffered terribly and people have just sort of shaken it off. Journalist Carol Sala has written about being in the latter category. But no, there won't be a major conspiracy theory, and it won't, of course, impress the conspiracy theorists who just move on to the next conspiracy. You can see why it was expedient and convenient just to gloss over it or say this is unbelievable, or to say, well, it must be the victim's fault. Of course, there's a parallel here with attitudes towards rape. Remember, we were much more naive about sex in every sense of the word. The Victorian legacy 40 or 50 years ago, coming out of that period in the so-called swinging 60s, you know, we did and said some daft things as well as wore flared trousers, and ignoring young people who complained. I know of a case of a woman whose brother finally plucked up the courage, makes you weep to think of it, to tell his father what was going on at an expensive school. What did his father do? He beat him.
Well, there's plenty more of this on our website at theguardian.com/politics. Now, the time has come to set a threshold, says the Prime Minister, who has pledged that the next Conservative manifesto will contain a vow to outlaw strikes which follow from ballots with a low turnout. It comes as up to 1 million teachers and other public sector workers go on strike. Now, Polly Toynbee, the strikes are on today, and Ed Miliband has refused to swing behind them. Do you think he's right to refuse?
Well, no Labour leader has ever supported a strike ever, and often at great cost. I mean, Neil Kinnock did not support the miners. There has never been a time when a Labour leader has, because it's just been the tradition the way it is. But on this occasion, it's particularly difficult because Labour has also signed up to a pay freeze for public sector workers. So it'd be quite difficult for them to suddenly say, well, good idea to strike against this government, but it's partly our policies, though I don't think Labour's policy would last as long as 2018, which is what's threatened now. But what Cameron said is really interesting. If you started to have a new threshold for elections, think of all the people who would no longer be legitimate in the House of Commons. We wouldn't have any police and crime commissioners where there was a turnout of only 15%. Large numbers of local authorities would be illegitimate because most of the councillors are elected on very low turnouts. What you need to do is find ways to make it easier for people to vote. And on this occasion, it would be letting people vote in their workplace. But Cameron won't have that.
Edmund, when you describe industrial action as the right to withdraw your labour, it sounds like a very good liberal idea. But liberals aren't always terribly keen on strikes, are they?
That's putting it mildly. I mean, there's a strong liberal tradition of Clemenceau, great French leader, was a great strike breaker. He set up the CRS, the riot police, in order to break strikes early in the 20th century. Polly's absolutely right. Liberal politicians, left or right, are very reluctant to support strikes. There has been an anti-labor tradition in liberalism and liberal democracy. However, since 1945, there has been an acceptance of labor demands. I mean, look at Germany. They have created, it seems to me, a much better labor capital industrial balance than in this country.
Mike, what do you think about today's strikes? Are the people going to get behind them?
Well, the public is much less hostile to trade unions and trade unionism in the nowadays than they were before 20 or 30 years of steady drip, drip, drip weakening of them and a fall off of their membership, particularly in the private sector. I think I saw somewhere that about 60% of the public, you know, support the right to strike and have some sympathy with these low-paid, mainly low-paid workers who are out today, mainly low-paid women workers. We've all been grappling in our different ways with Thomas Piketty's, I'm sure you have, Tom, great work on capital and the growing power of capital. And one of the things it's growing at the expense of is labor. And it's pointed out by Piketty, as by others, that countries which have reasonably strong and reasonably decent trade unions, pretty responsible these days by and large, have a better balance in society between extremely high levels of remuneration and starvation wages, if I can put it that way. We're out of balance quite badly. I grew up, we're talking a moment ago about the 60s and the 70s, an awful lot of irresponsible trade union activity, particularly the shop stewards movement, strikes with no proper mandate and not much justification. That's all gone. These are strikes by people who are making a protest, who want an extra pound an hour, and, you know, they're the people who need it most, and they're the people who spend the pound, and therefore the economy, you might say, will benefit from extra spending power which these people get. It isn't all about paying off the government's deficit, which it has failed to do anyway, despite squeezing the public sector workers extremely hard. I'm on their side this time. I'm not always.
Edmund, I can see you're nodding there.
No, I completely agree with Michael. And, again, come back to Germany. I mean, Germany has higher employment, lower inflation, better labour products, activity, higher wages, higher minimum wage than Britain, and much better industrial relations. It's a high-pay country that is in balance with the rest of the world, indeed high surplus with the rest of the world. Whereas
scandalously
Britain,
high surplus.
Well, Germany can never get it right. I mean, it does everything right, and when it gets this huge surplus, it's bad.
I think it's only just introduced a minimum wage, hasn't it, under pressure from the SPD
it has,
and the coalition?
It has, but it's higher than it's going to be higher than the British one. But no, the point is they have much better industrial relations. They're a high-pay country, whereas Britain is a low-pay country, and this is one of the great difficulties.
So, Polly, are we stuck in the early 1980s mindset in the way we report this and the way it's discussed in Parliament?
Depends what you mean by we. If you look at the majority of the press, after all, 80% of our press is Tory supporting today, that we certainly says with one voice, this is disgraceful. What about poor parents who don't know what have to take a day off work? It's very inconvenient. But it does seem that there's quite strong support amongst parents for the teachers. And, you know, The name Michael Gove is a kind of boo word.
He was on a picket line once, you know, on the Aberdeen Press and Journal in his youth. I've seen the photographs.
Yes. I think there is strong public support for public sector workers. One of the arguments the government uses, which is extremely disingenuous, is to say, well, of course, the public sector workers, on average, are paid more than the private sector workers who've taken an even bigger hit since the crash. Part of the reason why, of course, is that private sector workers don't have trade unions on the whole. Almost all trade unions is in the public sector.
But they're also low-skilled. The low-skilled bottom of the pot, that's what pulls down private sector wages. It's a built-in distortion, and the government should know that, and does.
Well, more of today's strike on our website. But finally today, obituaries of British liberalism have been trotted out in these last few post-slump years. Edmund, in the light of 200 years of not experience, but of reading about experience, do you think that this is a glad time to be a liberal, or do you think people are right to worry?
I think it's always a good time to be a liberal, but I think people are right to worry. Worrying about the future of liberalism is absolutely nothing new. I mean, if you look back over the last 80 years, you can always find a book from the strange death of liberal England in the 1930s to the strange death of the strange death of liberal America in quite recently, predicting the demise of a great tradition. You can tell yourself a very bleak picture about liberal democracy. Threats from outside, low pay, poverty, struggling to cope with welfare services that don't meet their promises, overstretched governments. I don't do that. I think that there can be a change of attitude to get back some of the confidence that particularly Europe, the United States, had in a much broader, inclusive liberal democracy after the Second World War that was undermined by several things, by economic difficulties, but also by people in think tanks who were dismissed at the time as being right-wing lunatics, but slowly became the conventional wisdom. And it seems to me that something similar is happening now. You've got deleterious economic trends that are increasing popular support for a much more inclusive sort of social democratic liberalism. And at the same time, you have, beginning in think tanks, intellectuals who are saying this neoliberal consensus over which we have lived and suffered in the last 30, 40 years is wrong. It has to be replaced.
But you're confident that these big issues, I mean, people talk about, you know, the maldistribution of income. Mike was just talking about the maldistribution of investment, whether China, with its some central planning, is sharper than we are now with our casino for allocating investment.
Too early to tell, Tom.
I come back to Germany. I mean, as it were, the Germans don't sit down. Look at their soccer. I mean, the Germans don't sit down and say to themselves, "Oh my goodness, the world is falling around us. We're going to be competed into annihilation by the Chinese." They get on with the job and they do it fantastically well. And it seems to me that they should be the model we should be looking at. And just one final thing, it puzzles me in Europe, and I've never understood this, as to why we have this utterly neurotic view of the European Union, with, you know, Germany and France at its heart. It may have something to do with the fact that we've got a Tory-controlled press that is owned by non-Europeans.
And non-taxpayers.
I sometimes fantasize about how it would be if the if some large British press organ had been bought by the Bertelsmann group rather than by we don't need to say who.
No, we don't.
Mike, do you think that these soundings off you get about the old system having failed, you know, ranging from think tank reports about the way investment's done to Russell Brand saying there's no point in voting, don't encourage them?
Russell Brand's an idiot. Let's not waste time on him. But let's not. I know he's not an idiot at the Guardian, but none of us is perfect. Let's not ignore the enormous gorilla in the room, of which we've not made mention yet, which is the response to the failures of neoliberalism, which is really nothing to do with Edmund's liberalism. It's sort of economic Thatcherism. It's high Victorian Thatcherism of Mr. Gladstone. The real gorilla in the room isn't a revival of liberalism in an Edmund Fawcett, J.K. Galbraith sense, but of right-wing authoritarian populism.
And that's, do you mean UKIP?
That's the bit. They're only a fairly mild, by European standards, or Tea Party standards even, a fairly mild a virus. But there's no reason why that virus shouldn't mutate and Nigel Farage be pushed aside by somebody who really knows how to press the buttons. So that's my primary concern. I wanted to ask Edmund Fawcett a question. He lists, he's going to do it first now, four sort of essential components of liberalism. But among the four, several reviewers have noted, not reviewed in The Guardian yet, Edmund, is that right?
No, indeed.
Oh, well,
I'm waiting expectantly.
We'll do our best. Other reviewers, not in The Guardian, have said, where's liberty in that? Tell us why it isn't there.
Two reasons. One is that virtually every rival of liberalism has claimed to stand, wave the flag of liberty. Communist Manifesto, published 1848, a few days ago, July the 5th. Mussolini, dictator of fascist Italy, said, fascists are libertarians who believe in liberty even for their enemies. Liberty is there, actually, in my four ideas, standing up to power and civic respect for everybody in an inclusive way, whoever they are. I mean, you could read those both as liberty. Perhaps there was an element of party trick here. I wanted to avoid a word that struck me as having been over-engineered by the intellectuals in the philosophy departments, rather like a sort of urban Maserati. The engineering was brilliant, but it was very little for street
use. I thought you did very well on leaving liberty out, because it's always pitted against equality.
Yes.
And liberalism stands somewhere between, with a foot in each camp. I think you also do very well and pointing out how the extent to which the right has stolen the word liberalism. They've just run off with it. I mean, you know, liberal economics, In the same way, they've run off with the word liberty or freedom. You know, freedom, the moment you see the word freedom attached to any kind of party now, you know it's of the far right. The idea of free markets means the right to trample over anything and anybody, regardless of any other social consequences, whatever.
That's freedom from.
Completely, I completely agree, Polly. That's absolutely right. And part of the reason I wrote this book was to try and, as it were, recover liberalism from, to some extent, the neglect of the intellectual left. I mean, the left and liberals are very close together. And from capture by the neoliberal right. And I completely agree. Freedom is a slogan that has been greatly abused.
And one of your four is the inevitability of conflict of interest.
Yes.
Of
strikes, for example.
Pluralism, if you like. So do you see that those free market forces trampling everything else, do you see that as anti-liberal because it's a kind of monomania, a sort of markets will trump all else?
I think it is. I think once you accept that, as it were, wealth and markets are somehow the one answer to every problem, that's a kind of dogmatism. It's monopolistic. It's dictatorial, intellectually and socially.
And Polly, when you look across the European election results that we had last month, so UKIP, Mike says, a mild version of it, Le Pen, maybe a stronger version of the same thing in France. Do you think that we're seeing at least a broadly based rejection of the kind of virtues that Edmund's talking about, not just a narrow market point, but the thing about being able to handle conflict, the suspicion of power and all of these virtues?
Not altogether, because when you unpick, for instance, what UKIP voters think in this country, they're passionate about immigration and therefore Europe, because they see it as losing control of our borders. But they are also people who feel very strongly about inequality, about poverty, about angry with the rich as well. It doesn't come as one package. The immigration thing is just so overwhelming. But a lot of these are Labour voters with essentially Labour other points of view, so that it's slightly less obvious.
But you see that pattern exactly, Polly, across Europe and in the United States, that you have people not at the top of the pile who have quite hard lives in some ways and who take it out on foreigners or take it out on people who have even less hard lives. It's a very common pattern.
A lot of these responses are illiberal. You might say liberalism is a luxury you can afford when you've got a full belly, that the UKIP responses in many ways are deeply liberal. That's why I use the word authoritarian, and much more so in other places, of course. And that's rather frightening, especially when yoked to revive nationalism of the kind, begging Edmund's respect, the EU is designed to dissolve or neutralize, but seems to be fighting its way back 100 years after the great disaster.
It's true, but the far right. I mean, I like your point, Michael. Actually, because I think the far right, the rise of, as it were, the populist authoritarian right, is yet another reason, funnily enough, to be quite hopeful about liberal democracy, because it's often quite useful to have a fear, have something you don't want to happen. And after all, you know, 20th century, we have good enough examples of how disastrous authoritarian populism can be. So, as it were, having a little homeopathic dose of it in the form of, you know, lunatic Michael, what's he called, Farage.
And that, of course, is why the German economy and its components behave so well.
Indeed, they got it as badly wrong as anybody can,
yeah.
And they're determined not to do it again.
Now, you're talking principally in a non-parochial way about big ideas rather than party labels, or almost brand names, you call them. However, I can't resist, because we have a weakness for parochialism perhaps on this programme, but you do have this line: liberals in office have often shown a rightward pull towards the conservative defence of the order, established wealth and orthodoxy. And so I do have to just ask, are you worried that in Britain, given the state of Nick Clegg's Liberal Democrats, that liberalism might now be a creed without a vehicle?
If the Liberal Democrats are the expected vehicle, I don't follow British politics nearly with the detail I should, but it doesn't look to me. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's lost a wheel, but it doesn't look in great shape. I wouldn't look to them as the vehicle.
Okay, well, that's all we've got time for this week. You can find Edmund Fawcett's book, Liberalism, The Life of an Idea, in all respectable bookshops now. My thanks to Polly Toynbee and to Michael White, as well as to him. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.